All right, I'm ready to start. Are y'all ready? I really appreciate the visiting. It's fun. So let's do it. I'm trying to share my screen, and then I have to rearrange everything. All right, I think we're on the last lesson. It's the last day of August, so that's where we should be. I'll get my little pen out here. So here we are. The last lesson is the very disturbing lesson, according to the Bible Project. And in our outline, of course, it's the second story in this third section of the book, which describes the cultural decline. And remember that these events probably took place way earlier up, if not that this is a chronological chart, but maybe in the very early. In fact, we'll note that the priest Phinehas, was still the priest at this time, if it's the same one, in one of the incidents of the story. So it occurred earlier, but it's said in the book to kind of show we saw a little bit of a decline through the judges in their spirituality and other things, and now we have this kind of cultural picture, which is a kind of a terrible ending in a way for the book of Judges. And we'll go through the story. I have decided it's three whole chapters. One is very long. I'm not going to read everything. I'm going to step through the events, but if you note something in the text, that like a word or a particular phrase or something is puzzling, I'd love to stop and address it, but I'm not going to read every word in the text. We'll just cover all the events. All right, quick review. And now you've graduated where you don't even need the names of the tribes. I can just call out a letter, and you can tell me what tribe is in that spot. So let's start with A. A is way up here. What's A?
Manasseh.
Good, that's Manasseh East. What's B right here? Right
in
the
back.
This car, right, where the cars drive well. What is C, this big area here on the west of Jordan?
Manasseh.
It's Manasseh West. Yes. D, that way down here.
Simeon.
Yeah, we just kind of put it down there. E. E is over here.
Yeah. Reuben.
Yep, it's so that's almost the three Transjordan tribes. That's one of them. So F is up here by the sea.
Asher,
good. G is up here way in this little corner area.
Dan,
very good. H is down here in this large area.
Judah.
I?
Dan.
Dan again, jammed over by the sea. J?
It's Billy Ephraimites.
Yep, that's right. The hillbillies, or the hill country, or the mountains of Ephraim. Yeah, H-I-J-K, after... What's K then? That's the other Transjordan tribe.
Yeah.
Great. AJKL. What would this tribe be sandwiched between Ephraim and Judah? Real important for tonight's lesson.
Benjamin.
Good. And then HIJKL. M. The last one kind of jammed in up here. It's not actually the last one, but.
Zebulun.
I don't know how to remember that one. And N stands for?
Naphtali.
Very good. I'm going to add one. What is this area over here called O? And I've just kind of shaded it in, and it kind of covers parts of these three tribes, maybe not as far up as Bashan, but what's this O area called?
Gilead.
That's good. And we actually are going to hear about a town in Gilead called Jabesh Gilead, meaning it's Jabesh in Gilead. We'll read about that tonight. And really our story, a little bit like the last one, is all centered around this area down here. It starts in Bethlehem. Well, really, it starts in Ephraim, I guess. And the concubine runs away to Bethlehem. And then the fellow finally travels up past Jerusalem to Gibeah, which you can't really see here, but it's in Benjamin. It's covered over by the word Benjamin. And then Bethel, I think, enters into the story. At least the house of God enters in, if it means the name of the city, it could be that, but also Mizpah, which is down in this area, and Rock Rimmon, which is probably over here somewhere, and Jabesh Gilead, which is up here somewhere. So that's kind of the area where the story will take place. And I'll have a map as we go through. So very good. I hope you feel good about learning all those locations of the tribe. And more important, I hope they are kind of tools to understand more of the story and geography and even the history of the tribes. Let's start in Judges 19, and we'll pause after that and do a little group thing. But starting in Judges 19, it came to pass in those days when there was no king in Israel that there was a certain Levite staying in the remote mountains of Ephraim. Now, We almost see always it's the hill country of Ephraim. Some translations say the mountains of Ephraim. Remember, we studied why that was so. Why did Ephraim end up in the mountains? You don't have to answer. You probably remember. They were not able to conquer the flat areas. In fact, they complained, not the first or the last time they complained, to Joshua about not getting enough territory. And he said, well, if you're such a big tribe, then you go take your land like you're supposed to. Anyway, so we'll see that the hill country or the mountains of Ephraim is referred to several times. Anyway, a Levite lived there, and he took himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. I don't understand concubines. They have apparently the rights of a wife, but it doesn't seem like it has the same level of commitment. Maybe it's a way to get an extra wife or something, but anyway. So I don't know what a Levite is doing having a concubine. It doesn't seem like the right thing to do to me, but anyway. But worse than that, his concubine played the harlot. You know what that means? So she was immoral against him and went away from him to her father's house in Bethlehem in Judah, and was there for 4 whole months. Then her husband arose, and sees how he's called her husband, so there's some connection, you know, that's permanent and maybe some, responsibility. And I suppose to his credit, he went after her to speak kindly to her to bring her back, having his servant and a couple of donkeys with him, so probably one for her to ride back on if he was successful. So she brought him into her father's house, and the father of the young woman saw him, and he was glad to meet him. So maybe he was hoping his daughter would go back and maybe do right, or, you know, maybe he was a better husband to her than whoever she had taken up with. I don't know. Now his father-in-law, the young man's father, detained him, and he stayed with him 3 days. So they ate and drank and lodged there. Okay. I hope you know where the story's going. I hope you know roughly kind of the events of the story. What I'd like to do is a kind of a group exercise just to warm up a little bit. Think about the whole story. You know, what's going to happen is a bad thing happens in Gibeah, then the nation gets riled up, and then the Benjamites get riled up, and then they have a war, and they almost kill all the Benjamites off, and then they have to find wives and all that. What I'd like you to do is just think about all the possible implications. I know we can't exhaust the possibilities, all you can think of at least, of the phrase, there was no king in Israel. Does that assignment make sense? I mean, you can think of it in a lot of different dimensions, spiritual, political, social, military, all those kind of things. So what I'd like to do is break into groups, and let's see if we got 4, 6, 8, 12. Five groups. Let's do four. That'll be about 4 to 5 participants each. All right. Everybody got the assignment? I'll broadcast it out after you're in your groups. But anyway, just take 3 or 4 minutes, brainstorm some thoughts about, and you can look at the whole book of Judges too as well. Anyway, there was no king in Israel. What are the implications? Okay, go.
Hello.
Okay. It was lawless. It was like the city of Portland. It was completely lawless.
Good comparison.
Yeah. I mean, it's going on today in major cities. There's no rule. There's no ruler. There's no law.
Everybody's doing what they think is right in their own eyes. That's what we see here.
Judge king in terms of they're not recognizing God as king, or no king as in they need somebody like David to impose some governmental authority. Probably both, right?
And looking from the Levite, I don't think there's moral authority. I didn't like that concubine idea. I don't excuse that. And especially it seems so immoral, you know. I would not have been a woman, wanted to be a woman in those days. Would you, ladies? It's sickening.
It's probable that Samuel wrote this, right? So the question would be, at what point did Samuel write this? Was it after there was, I would assume it was after there was a first king in Israel.
A Benjamin king.
Huh?
The Benjaminite king.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ironic.
So, I mean, he's kind of also just giving them the, you know, as a group, the nation had to come to conclusions on what to do as opposed to one authority, because they're not seeing God as king,
right,
but one authority that says this is wrong and this is judgment that's laid down because of it. So it's really just kind of a lack of, or seen as a lack of authority because they're not doing what they should be doing, of course.
And there's really, you can say it was vigilante justice, you can say. Versus a king.
Resorting to lots, right? You know, they didn't have somebody to organize the
response.
Battle. Yeah, the response.
Yeah.
There was no law, no judge when infractions were administered. Mm-hmm. There was no judge.
You get a national response, you got to chop somebody up and send it everywhere. There's body parts everywhere, you know, instead of just going to the king.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Also, it seems like all the tribes themselves were kind of had individualized themselves. We're this tribe, we're this tribe, we're this tribe. It wasn't so much a nation that were upholding one law as one group. It was kind of each group saw themselves as their own entity. And while they had kind of allegiance with the rest of the Israelites, they didn't seem to work together or function together at all.
Yeah. And think about the rest of the tribe of Benjamin, or even the city, give up the evildoers, or the rest of the tribe of Benjamin, give up the evildoers. Instead, they felt like an allegiance to their own tribe instead of just the national Israelite identity.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Family before God, or family before anything.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, even most immediate family instead of extended family.
Yeah.
Right. But I mean, there should have been a law that dictated everything that they were doing, and it shouldn't have been necessary to have a king, because the king is really just there for the law and, I guess, enforcement of the law. But if you already have the law and you already know the people that are supposed to enforce the law, then a king shouldn't be essential. But as Samuel's right,
following the
like there's an understanding that once a king was there,
all right. So let's all go off mute and just give me some quick answers for different concepts you came up with. Just quick answers. No king in Israel. What's the implications of that?
No leadership.
Okay. What would a leader have done? What would have been beneficial to have a leader?
Well, you haven't covered the part yet, but when he chopped up the female and sent out the body parts, if they had a leader, then a leader could have made a decision on how to deal with the way she was killed versus sending out body parts.
Okay, yeah.
Well, I mean, the problem, though, is even that they had a leader, they just weren't willing to think of a spiritual creator as being their leader.
Okay. So this is often paired with what was said to Samuel when they wanted a king later. Maybe he said, God said, I haven't rejected you, they've rejected me, that I wouldn't be king over. And so there's definitely that connection. But I think there are other things too. So, I mean, Teresa just mentioned a central authority of some kind. What are some other things that if they'd had a king might have been different, or maybe this story illustrates the problem of not having a king?
Well, Marty, I guess a little bit off. Shouldn't they have gone to Shiloh and inquired of the Lord?
Yes, and actually Judah did do that. Not Shiloh, but it's not clear. Look. Yeah. It's possible that the ark maybe was at Bethel, if that's the name of the city. I don't know, but they did inquire of the Lord three different times. And of course he told them to go up two times. He told them to go up knowing, obviously they didn't, but that they were going to get defeated and have massive losses. You know? So that's it.
The ark wouldn't have been moved until the days of Samuel. So this is possibly further back in time. The ark would have been at Shiloh possibly.
That's right. It just says in the text the ark was there in those days, and it's right after a reference to Bethel. But that could be the house of God at Shiloh. It could be the literal Bethel, which is nearby. It's not clear. But anyway, so they did acquire the Lord. Nate, what are you going to say?
I was going to say, it seems like they identify primarily by tribe as opposed to being just the nation of Israel. If they have a king, then yeah, they will be less likely to go, you know, have a civil war against each other.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a unifying force at having a single authority. Yeah, that's right. Good. That's a good one. I heard some other real good illustrations. I think Brigham or somebody was saying something about they had no example or no role model or no something like that.
Well, we discussed about the organization of the response to the wickedness. The king in the role of a judge would have also been very helpful.
Yeah, yeah. Judicial Judge Sewell.
Israel is morally defunct. Just overall, the nation is morally defunct.
Okay, so in theory, a king perhaps might have had some moral authority and actually judged the city of Gibeah for their crimes before they even got to the point of the violence that they committed against the concubine. That's a possibility, but at least moral law might have been upheld with the leader. Yeah. Sewell, what were you going to say?
I was saying they made a rash vow and then had difficulty trying to get around it.
Yeah.
They had a judge and a king. They could have avoided that, perhaps.
Sure. You like to think that a leader, a king, might have a more of a level head. You get the sense, we haven't read it yet, but there's a sense of just like everybody getting everybody else excited. And even in, I think, in over-destroying Benjamin, there's some evidence that because they had suffered such terrible losses, they just couldn't stop after they destroyed the city of Gibeah. I may be stretching that, but yeah, Ryan.
So just the idea of them being morally off. I mean, we see kings later, and kings were terrible, but they made the direction that if
yeah, good point.
He said this is the way it's going to be. Right. Everybody didn't do what was right in their own eyes, but that doesn't mean that they did what was right.
That's right.
Because the king was there.
That's right. Yeah, I think there's a lot of things here, and I even think about the Book of Judges, probably written in the time of Samuel when the kingdom was finally forming. Yes, Sewell.
Marty, we sometimes think about Romans 13 and that government is appointed by God. But the fact is that bad government is better than no government.
Yeah, because
there's no better illustration of this than right here, I think.
Yeah, that's a little along the line of Ryan saying at least there's a direction, right, even if it's a bad one. And I think generally when there's a descent into chaos, people would definitely take a tyrant over that, you know, just that chaos. At least there's something somewhat predictable and orderly. Anyway, I'm just saying that when you get to maybe the time that the book was written, there, you know, I do know too that the Philistines were a huge threat, and I think there was this appeal to Samuel, we need a military leader too, right? That was part of the appeal as well. So I just think it's a broad concept, but it definitely sets the tone for the story. All right, I'm going to skip through some of the events, and for the sake of time, we'll read a text or two just for the interest of it. So the Levite comes to Bethlehem, as we said, to seek his concubine, to bring her back home. He stays for 3 days. He says, I'm leaving in the morning. I can't stay any longer. But he gets up, and then the generosity of his host delays his departure till really almost the evening. Well, in this map over here, you can kind of see. So he's at Bethlehem, and he's trying to get home somewhere up in the hill country of Ephraim. Maybe that's up here somewhere. So he starts on his journey. Well, he's not going to get very far. And you can kind of see in kilometers down here what the distances are. And so he comes to Jebus. And remember, Jerusalem, perennially not conquered, right, until the time of David. The Jebusites live there. And his servant suggests, well, let's just stop off there. But he says, no, let's don't go to a place where they're, you know, not Israelites, as if that would be unsafe somehow, kind of ironic. And so he goes on and he comes to the city of Gibeah in Benjamin. That's all right over here. And it's late in the day, apparently night already. And so he's just sitting in the square, apparently has his own food and everything he needs. But an old man who is not from Gibeah in Benjamin, who is from Ephraim, the hill country of Ephraim, of course, finds him and says, what are you doing here? And let's just read a little bit of that. However, the man was not willing to spend that night, so he rose and departed. Oh, I think we already covered that. Let's go ahead and get down here. They turned aside there to go in to get lodging Gibeah. And when he went in, he sat down in the open square for no one would take them into his house to spend the night. Just then an old man came in from the work in the fields that evening, who also was from the mountains of Ephraim. He was staying in Gibeah, whereas the men of the place were Benjamites. When he raised his eyes, he saw the traveler in the open square of the city. And the old man said, "Where are you going? Where do you come from?" So he said, "We're passing from Bethlehem in Judah to the remote mountains of Ephraim. I am from there. I went to Bethlehem in Judah. Now I'm going to the house of the Lord. But there is no one who will take me into his house. Although we have straw and fodder for our donkeys and bread and wine for myself, for your female servant, for the young man who's with us, there's no lack of anything." And the old man said, "Peace be to you. However, let all your needs be my responsibility. Only do not spend the night in the open square." Why do you think he said that? Does that seem like an urgent warning? Is he just wanting to be hospitable, or does he maybe have something else in mind? Don't stay out here. Do you think it's possible he was warning them of the danger, perhaps? So he brought them into his house and gave fodder to the donkeys, and they washed their feet and ate and drank. All right, so what happens then in the night is the perverted men who are called in the Hebrew sons of Belial, or sons of vanity, is emptiness or worthlessness, I think, or worthless men is some of the translations, but sons of worthlessness. And we'll talk some more about that phrase. Only I'll just mention it now. It's a phrase that's found several times in the Old Testament referring to terrible people. In fact, it seems like, I forgot his name. Who's the guy up on the hill throwing rocks at David? You remember that when David was
Shimei?
Yeah. Thank you. I believe he calls David a worthless fellow in this thing. So I don't really know for sure if it just means a pretty dumb, worthless person, or if it actually is a euphemism for something worse, like a homosexual. I don't know. But either way, it would be a deep insult. Anyway, in the text, they're called the sons of Belial, and they said, "We want this Levite to come out." And so instead of that, the Levite and the man offers his daughter. The Levite puts his concubine outside, and she's abused and killed during the night. The Levite returns home, and he takes his knife once he gets home, and he cuts up the body, and he sends her body parts to all of Israel. So I want to read some of this just to see the text. As they were enjoying themselves, this is back in Gibeah, now in the Ephraimite's house, or a house that he was staying in. As they were enjoying themselves, suddenly certain men of the city, perverted men, and that's the sons of Belial reference, surrounded the house and beat on the door, spoke to the master of the house, the old man, saying, "Bring out the man who came to your house that we may know him." And carnally is interpolated, I mean, you know, is added in to help us understand what they mean, but it's pretty obvious what the phrase "know him" means. It means to know him intimately or sexually. But the man, the master of the house, went out to them and said, to them, "No, my brethren, I beg you, do not act so wickedly. Seeing this man has come into my house, do not commit this outrage. Look, here is my virgin daughter and the man's concubine. Let me bring them out now. Humble them. Do what you will. Do with them as you please. But to this man, do not do such a vile thing." So it's pretty clear what their intent was from the phrases and all of that. But the men would not heed him. So the man took his concubine and brought her out to them. I assume that's the Levite, not the host. And they all knew her. They knew her, abused her all night until morning. And when the day began to break, they let her go. So I don't even know how to explain why he would send her out. Maybe he felt he was in danger. Cherry, yes, please.
This is really almost a mirror of what happened in Lot's case.
Genesis 9.
When the angels came to Sodom and they were going to stay in the open square, and he insisted that they not. The men came to the door, and he was willing to send out his daughters to them. There was something about the hospitality issue. It was better to do that than to let the man go out to them.
It's clearly a defense of hospitality. I mean, he even kind of says that. He's come into my house as if that was an important part, you know, of the story. It's interesting, though, in the Genesis 19 account in Sodom, they were angels, if you remember. And in the end, the angels had to jerk the Lot back in, and actually strike the men of the city with blindness. Remember that. That's how they were kind of rescued. And what's interesting is in the end in Sodom, besides the fire and brimstone from heaven, or, you know, burning up the city, but really in the end, nothing terrible happened that night. So it's odd that in this pagan city of Sodom, nothing happened, but here in the Israelite city, they did it. They got away with it. So it was kind of a, I think there's several cases all through the Old Testament, it seems like, where you look at the pagans and somehow Israel manages to outdo them in their paganness. You know what I mean? And almost that seemed like the way this story is here. Anyway, keep reading. Yeah. So then the woman came as the day was dawning and fell down at the door of the man's house where her master was till it was light. Sorry, I've got to. It's always this time of the class. Every Monday is my VPN times out because I started, I think, exactly 12 hours ago, logging in. But anyway. When the master arose in the morning, opened the doors of the house and went out to go his way, there was his concubine fallen at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold, almost as if she was trying to get back in and that she just couldn't go any further. And he said, "Get up and let's be going," which seems a little bit heartless, say the least. But there was no answer. So the man lifted her onto his donkey and the man got up and went to his place. When he entered his house, he took a knife, laid hold of the concubine, divided her into 12 pieces limb by limb, and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel. Cherry, you probably know that's a parallel of something else, too.
Somebody chopped up oxen and sent them out.
That's right. Saul did. And we'll get to that later. But, yep, exactly right. And he sent her through all the territory of Israel. And so it was that all who saw it said, "No such deed had been done or seen from the day that the children of Israel came up from the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it, confer, and speak up." So I don't know if he sent a message with it or if they were just offended that her body had been cut up. I don't really know. But whatever it was, it got them excited. And they all came. And so I was going to stop for a minute and just mention what the law was with regard to homosexuality. Clearly in Leviticus 20, if a man lies with a male as he lies with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood shall be upon them. Over and over, it occurs to me that I don't know how you go. If you got a band of homosexuals that are running around threatening people, it seemed like something had gone wrong long before that, right? I mean, it's not like, what do you do? I don't know what the good decision. No, the wrong had actually occurred long before. Leviticus 18 is a similar mention. And it mentions there the phrase abomination, and it's in the context of other things like bestiality and other things. So it seems like it has a special category. And it also appears to be associated sometimes with idolatry. But remember, idolatry is just a where you make up your own gods to do what you want to do anyway, it seems to me. So I'm not sure there's that much significance in that. But here in Deuteronomy 12, there shall be no ritual harlot of the daughters of Israel or a perverted one. And guess what that phrase is? That's a devoted one. Sorry. Devotee of licentious idolatry of the sons of Israel. So that would be a male prostitute. And then don't bring the wages. So anyway, all right, let's keep on going. So what happens is the tribes gather together at Mizpah. You can see that over here on the map. They come from all over, all over here in Israel and come down to Mizpah to see what's going on. And so at that point, the Levite recounts the story of what has happened to him in Gibeah. And so all the children of Israel came out from Dan to Beersheba. Again, I don't know if Dan has already been in the north, but it's referring to that northern Dan and down to Beersheba. So whoever's writing it is using the geography of later, right? So don't know if Dan had settled in that area yet or not, but it doesn't matter. As well as from the land of Gilead. Guess what? Gilead. And remember that because apparently not everybody from Gilead came, as it turns out. So, but some did. And the congregation gathered together as one man before the Lord at Mizpah. And the leaders of all the people, the tribes of Israel, presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 foot soldiers who drew the sword. the children of Benjamin heard that the children of Israel had gone up to Mizpah. The children of Israel said, tell us, how did this wicked deed happen? And then I'm skipping the verses where he retells the story, verse 8. So all the people arose as one man, saying, none of us will go to our tent, to his tent, nor will any turn back to his house. But now this is the thing we will do to Gibeah. We will go up against it by lot. We will take 10 men out of every 100 throughout all the tribes of Israel, 100 out of every 1,000, 1,000 of every 10,000 to make provisions for the people. I'll just note that it's not clear whether 9 out of 10 went to fight and then 1 out of 10 made provisions, or if 1 out of 10 went to fight and the others made provisions. It seemed like it's the first, because that's a lot of people that they managed to muster. So it seemed like that if you got the lot 1 out of 10, you didn't have to go, but you could help supply the troops with stuff. So maybe that was the idea. I don't really know. The way this reads, it looks like the other way, but I think the translation could be either way. And 1,000 every year, 10,000 to make provisions that they, when they come to Gibeah and Benjamin, then they repay all the vileness that they have done in Israel. So all the men of Israel were gathered together against the city as one man. All right. I want to stop again and think about the law again. There is a law that seems to be the most applicable, not exactly relevant, and this is in Deuteronomy. And it apparently is describing a case where there are corrupt men, again, the same phrase, sons of Belial, who come out from among you and started seducing the cities or the inhabitants out of the city to go after other gods, which you have not known. If you hear about that, you need to look into it, which seems like what they're doing here. They listen to the witnesses and everything. And if it's true and certain that such an abomination was committed among you, you shall surely strike the inhabitants of the city with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying it. And that's the phrase which is devoting it, meaning that you destroy it, you burn it, and you don't get any of the spoils. It's dedicated wholly to God, right? And gather its plunder in the middle of the street, completely burn it with fire of the city. It shall be a heap. It shall not be built again, and so on and so on. So you get the idea. I don't know if this was the law they had in mind or if they just were out for vengeance or whatever, but this is as close to an instruction that God gives. Again, it does reference the sons of Belial, but that just could be an insult. But basically, the punishment then would be limited to that city, right? It's interesting now how this expands and becomes more of a national thing. By the way, I just have a question to ask. Does it seem unrealistic to you that an isolated event that happened in the small village of Gibeah with the right publicity would get a whole nation fired up, demonstrating and running all around and wanting to have vengeance and everything? Does that seem like that could ever happen in the world?
They didn't even have television.
I know that. Didn't have TV.
Or Twitter.
Yeah, or video cameras taking pictures of everything, right? But anyway, it just seems like with the right publicity, any kind of event like that will get a bunch of people stirred up. And obviously, it wasn't just the Israelites. Of course, what happened was then they came. I'll go ahead and go to the next thing. I need to cover this. So we see a couple of vows or plans that they made. One is they're not going home till Gibeah is punished. Second, they're going to draft people, 1 or 9 out of 10, I don't know which, and they create an army. That's the plan. There's 2 more vows that they make to make 4, but we don't learn about those until the next chapter. But I want to mention them now because it's important. Apparently, they made those vows at this time. And that is, look, anybody that didn't come here, we sent this, you know, concubines parts everywhere. So anybody that didn't show up, we're going to have to kill them too, right? That's how dedicated we are. That was one vow, chapter 21, verse 5. And then they also said no one is ever going to give their wives to Benjamin. And that's in chapter 21, verse 7. So we don't learn about those vows till after the battle, but it's clear that they made them, I think, before the battle. So that's important, too. Now, they did appeal to the rest of the tribes of Benjamin to hand over the guilty men. And not only did they refuse to deliver the guilty men, is Benjamin gathered themselves together. Now, does that ever happen? When one tribe of people gets all excited against another, and then the other tribe gets all excited and comes up in opposition to them, right? And then they have all kinds of civil unrest related to that. That could never happen, could it? Especially in a civilized land like ours. Anyway, so that happened. So Benjamites gathered, there were 26,000, which seems like not enough compared to 400,000. But they had 700 more select warriors who were left-handed and they could sling a sling and so on. I'll just read that. And from their cities, that means that not just Gibeah, but all the cities throughout Benjamin, the children of Benjamin numbered 26,000 men who drew the sword besides the inhabitants of Gibeah, who numbered 700 select men. Among all this people were 700 select men. I think a different 700, but I'm not sure. I don't think that all the left-handed people were in Gibeah. I think that's just how many Gibeah contributed, and then there were 700 select men. Everyone could sling a stone at a hair's breadth, right, and not miss. Besides Benjamin, the men of Israel numbered 400,000 who drew the sword. All these were men of war. Interesting that the Hebrew for left-handed, it's three different Hebrew words all strung together, separate words. And it means impeded, hand, and right. So it's impeded as to the right hand. So if you want to think of a left-handed person, that just means they're weak in their right hand. That's a way to think about it anyway. And also, you probably know that they could sling at a hair's breadth and not miss. And that word is also translated sin or iniquity or trespass in other places too. So interesting words there. So Israel decides to consult Jehovah, Yahweh is the term used there. And what God says is, well, Judah goes up first. Now, did he say they were going to win? No, he just said Judah goes up first. So that's what they did. And they lost, and they lost a bunch of people. In fact, 22,000 the first day. And then they asked him again, and they said, should we go up again? And he said, go up. Did he say they were going to win? Nope. And they didn't. They lost another 18,000. And it's clear that that's having an emotional toll because, you know, they seem like they're already upset and weeping. So the third day, they actually have a fast. They offer offerings. And they say, should we go up again? And apparently it's just a really sad day. And at that point, the message from God is, I will deliver them into your hands. And so, and I don't think these are successive days necessarily. It wasn't necessarily Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, right? These could have been a few days apart, and they'd gather for battle and have time in between, you know, to make these questions of Jehovah. So here's what it sounded like on the third day. Then all the children of Israel, that is all the people, went up and came to the house of God. And y'all know from your Hebrew here what that means. Is that the city Bethel, or is that just the house of God, wherever the house of God was? I don't know. And wept. It seemed like it could be Bethel because it's close by. They sat therefore before the Lord and fasted that day until evening. And they offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. So they hadn't done that on previous days. The children of Israel inquired of the Lord, and the Ark of the Covenant was there in those days, which is kind of interesting. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, stood before it in those days, saying, shall I yet again go out to battle against the children of my brother Benjamin, or shall I cease? And Yahweh said, go up, for tomorrow I will deliver them into your hand. So what happened on the third battle day, not necessarily the third day, but the third day of battle, is that Israel kind of set an ambush, hiding off, apparently way off out of sight from Gibeah, but then they attacked from the front, just like they had on the other days. And when the Benjamites came out, as they always had, the Israelites turned and ran as if they were being defeated. And in fact, some of them actually were killed, a 30 or some small number. And when the Benjamites believed again, they were routing them just like they had on the previous days. And so as Israel withdrew, the Benjamites pursued them. And then the ambush came in from behind, attacked the city, set it on fire. And the smoke was then a signal to the front forces that they had taken the city. And then the Benjamites turned and saw that the city had been taken and was burning. And when they tried to turn around, then they were trapped between the two forces and they were killed. And they tried to flee off into the, I guess the nearby areas and stuff, and they were just destroyed along the way. They were trampled. We'll read some of that, I think. And so they did that, and so the Benjamites were defeated, and all but 600 men were killed. And then it's almost like Israel, and who knows the right answer, but why they did it. But It was almost like they were so angry from having lost so many people that they just couldn't stop with Gibeah. And maybe the feeling was these other cities should have turned over these sinful men, and they didn't. But they just started going through all the cities. And so it was really almost a complete destruction of the tribe of Benjamin. Let's read a little bit of that. Therefore they, and that's the Benjamites, turned their backs before the men of Israel in the direction of the wilderness. But the battle overtook them. And whoever came out of the cities, they destroyed in their midst. They surrounded the Benjamites, chased them, easily trampled them down as far as the front of Gibeah toward the east. 18,000 men of Benjamin fell. All these were men of valor. They turned and fled toward the wilderness to the rock of Rimmon, and they cut down 5,000 of them on the highways. They pursued them relentlessly up to Gidom and killed 2,000 of them. So all who fell of Benjamin that day were 25,000 men who drew the sword. All these were men of valor. But 600 men turned and fled toward the wilderness to the rock of Rimmon, and they stayed at the rock of Rimmon for 4 months. And the men of Israel turned back against the children of Benjamin and struck them down with the edge of the sword from every city, men and beasts, all who were found. They also set fire to all the cities they came to. So it almost seems like the 600 just escaped because they wanted to go back and finish off the other cities in Benjamin. So I don't know how this strikes you. It's interesting, he keeps saying they were all men of valor, like good men, and they were all killed. But it's a pretty violent setting, and you can kind of see. I wonder if there was just some kind of rage in Israel, that they were already angry. The Benjamites stood up and defended their pride, I suppose. And then Israel got defeated and lost so many men day after day. And maybe they just felt like it was time for vengeance. It does seem, doesn't it? Doesn't it seem like they went beyond what the law would require, even if they were following that passage in Deuteronomy? So I don't know. It just seemed like there was a kind of a rage. So I mentioned two other things that we would think would never happen in this country, which seem to have happened. I wonder if this would ever happen, if rage got deep enough. And the social control and the moral standards were low enough that this could be the fate. I wonder if that would ever happen. Think a little bit about Romans 1. Romans 1 says the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all unrighteousness, ungodliness, unrighteousness of men. I think it's saying in the present tense that his wrath is revealed. I know in the judgment day things will be made right, but I think there are things God has designed into society in such a way that when we do certain way as a individual or as a group, the wrath of God kind of naturally comes upon us because of the way he set up the world. Here we see in the Judges that there was no external moral authority. You guys mentioned that. There was no king in Israel. And so, how will that work out? I wonder if this whole incident maybe is an example of the wrath of God being revealed when a society reaches this point. And so after that, in Romans 1, God gives them up to uncleanness, to the lust of their hearts. And we saw that this Levite has a concubine, and the concubine has a lover. You know what I mean? Do you see that kind of being illustrated in the story? We're already kind of, and you think the Levite would be a little bit more of a spiritual example and all of that. So there's the natural passions that are followed. And that's what Romans says. God gives them up to uncleanness to do the things that are naturally attractive, the lusts of their hearts. But then when that's not sufficient, and it never will be, of course, to satisfy us, God further gives them up, or us up, to vile passions, which are different. In this case, it's women with women and men with men, leaving the natural use of the woman. And of course, that's exactly what happens in the city of Gibeah. Already before the Levite arrives, these men are already giving way to their unnatural passions, homosexual and so on. And then the third element in Romans 1 is God gives them up one more time to a debased mind. And this time, you might think of these as victimless crimes, but these are crimes in which people are hurt and harmed in physical or other ways. And God gives them over to a debased mind. There's maliciousness and murder and strife and violence. Do you see any of that in these stories we just read? And that's exactly what happened here. When there's finally a full submission to human desires, people start getting killed. And I just will throw this footnote in. What do you think about the treatment of women so far in this story? I just see people shaking their heads. And you know more to come, right? As far as getting wives and all that. I just think we're kind of fooling ourselves to think that, that women will not be especially victimized when a society goes downhill. And I just think that's there's evidence in this story of that as well, in their treatment. Okay, so all that good news. So we're left with the Benjamites. And so Israel, apparently after the 4 months that they stayed up there at the Rock Rim, and they started to kind of feel bad about things. And so they mourned for the fact that the tribe and was lost. And so the first thing they did is they remembered that vow. Remember the third vow that if you don't come, we're going to kill you? Well, it turns out they looked around and Jabesh Gilead, remember, they're up here. Gilead, remember, over on the east side. Jabesh Gilead did not show up when all the nation of Israel showed up to punish Gibeah. So they said, okay, here's the deal. We got to keep our vow. Let's just make a, you know, let's make a double, to kill two birds with one stone. Let's go kill everybody up there except the virgins, and let's bring them back and let the Benjamites have them for wives. And so they did. Unfortunately, there weren't 600 of them. There were only 400, I guess. I don't know what the reason for that was, but that got a part of the way, but not all the way. So they destroyed Jabesh Gilead for that period of time, and then they brought back these girls and gave them to the Benjamites. I keep trying to imagine that ceremony, right? There's this huge herd of girls, and they just kind of bring them up to the Rock Rim or wherever and say, okay, everybody pick one or something. I don't know how that would – I just can't even imagine. The Shiloh thing's worse than that. And then they said, well, we hadn't got quite enough, so let's see. Up there in Shiloh, there's a feast every year. Maybe it was actually the Passover. But the girls would go out and dance as part of the ceremony. And so they told the Benjamites, look, you hide over into the side over there. And when they come out to dance, you just go get them and we won't do anything to you. So you go find every one of you, go catch a girl is kind of the way it actually is phrased in the text. And so they did it and they ran away. Well, the people of Shiloh were kind of complained a little bit. And the elders just, I mean, the Israelites said, well, now they told these well, you know, hey, you provided wives and you didn't break your vow because you didn't do it willingly, right? It's clear you didn't like what happened, so you didn't break your vow. So somehow or another, they were able to calm them down. And anyway, so out of that, then there were enough women for 600 men to have 600 wives, not each, but one each. And then, kind of recreate the nation of Benjamin or the tribe of Benjamin. And so the children of Benjamin did so. They took enough wives for their number from those who danced, whom they caught. And they went and returned to their inheritance, and they rebuilt the cities and dwelt in them. So the children of Israel departed from there at that time, every man to his tribe and family. And they went out from there, every man to his inheritance. And then the last verse in Judges, there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And that's kind of the way the book ends. And I don't know. I mean, you know, this is like the opposite of they lived happily ever after, right? It's kind of like just a sad ending. You know, you could think about Judges as being completely evil or at least chaotic. We did see some flashes of righteousness and courage and even godliness occasionally in the book, but we end with a pretty dismal picture. And then there's no king in Israel. But you know, there's another story in the Bible that takes place in the time of the Judges.
Aren't we thankful?
And right.
It is one of the most beautiful stories in the Bible, really. In fact, if you just go ahead and read the next verse, I want you to remember there was no king in Israel is the way the book of Judges ends. And I want you to just read the next verse in the Bible. It came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. And the name of the man was Elimelech. And y'all are Hebrew scholars now. What does Elimelech mean? We haven't studied that name, but you know what Eli means, right?
God.
God.
Yeah, El is God. What is Melech?
God is king.
God is king. Isn't that an interesting way that the next book starts after seeing that there was no king in Israel at the end of the book of Judges? And this man whom we meet in the beginning of the very next book says, well, God is my king. And that's kind of an interesting way that story begins. Okay. I tried to end with something a little bit more positive, but I'm not over. I still got a few minutes. I want to, Cherry's already brought up a kind of a very interesting connection, two of them. There's so many connections to this Gibeah story, I think, that are interesting. First is the similarity to the angels in Sodom, Genesis 19. Remember, too, the prophecy of Jacob about Benjamin. He's a ravenous wolf. In the morning, he'll devour the prey, and at night, divide the spoil. Benjamin is warlike, and we saw that all throughout the book, starting with Ehud and so on. It isn't over, by the way. If you read about the mighty men of David and others, you'll find other Benjamites who were, not to mention Saul, the king. They had war skills, and we saw them, even though they were defeated, they took a huge toll for 2 days before they were actually destroyed. They were the war heroes. You remember from earlier Ehud, and then later, you'll see that in 1 Samuel 9, and even later in recounting the men of David. And they had weapons and they had skills, as we talked about, left-handed and slinging stones at a hair's breadth and so on. Benjamin did remain very small. You can kind of read about that in 1 Samuel 9. An interesting thing is that Saul's hometown was this very town that we've read about, the town of Gibeah. And given that the book was written around the time that Saul and David, you know, were reigning, it's interesting. I wonder what the people who read it and had it read to them would think about Saul, knowing he was actually from that very town that did these terrible things and led to all that civil war in Israel. But then it's interesting that Saul he seemed to have a special relationship with Jabesh-Gilead. This was the story that we mentioned earlier. One of the first things, and maybe the best thing Saul ever did, I'm not sure, is that once they made him king and he went back to plowing. Remember that? Mm-hmm. And so what happened was word came that the men of Jabesh-Gilead were being threatened. I think it was Ammon. I'm not sure. I can't remember who was threatening, but basically said, you can be our slaves and I'll put out one of your eyes or something, or what you can fight us, which you want to do. And they said, well, give us a few days to see if anybody rescues us, right? And so Saul heard about it, and he cut an oxen. I guess he was plowing with that oxen in 12 pieces, summoned the nation to save Jabesh-Gilead, and they did. They got there in time, and they saved them. I wonder if Saul had any relatives in Jabesh-Gilead, you know what I mean? Because the wives, many of them came from Jabesh-Gilead. Maybe there was some relationship in Saul's lineage from the mom's side, I guess, at least. And then later, of course, when Saul was killed by the Philistines in battle, his body was hung up, and the men of Jabesh-Gilead came and rescued his body as it was hanging on the wall in Beth Shean, either way. So there's a lot of connections between Saul, a Benjamite, and Jabesh-Gilead. And then, of course, the story of Ruth also takes place not in Gibeah, which is that inhospitable city, but in Bethlehem, which is the hospitable city, remember? The city, house of bread. And, of course, guess whose hometown that is, right? That's David's hometown. So you see these two hometowns kind of almost in contrast in this story. Voluntary submission to Jehovah, care and provision for Ruth in the story that follows. And then, of course, the man's name is God is my king. Or God is king. I keep wanting to show this chart, but I think that maybe one way to look at the book of Judges is if you could take the photograph and make a negative image of it, you know what I mean? Where what's white is black and what's black is white. And maybe think about what would Judges have been like if they had followed God's plan and been faithful and obedient. And you can see hints of it in what some of the judges were able to do, but you can also see it in the sins, in the mistakes they made, in going after idols and depending on their own strength and so on. I think, first of all, they would have been unified. We talked about a king would be a unifying factor, but they would have been unified. Even without a central government, they would have been led locally by faith-filled people, Levites in particular. And if there was an enemy, these people would have been raised up by God, as they were in the book of Judges when the people finally would turn to God. There wouldn't be a need to compete for power or leadership because there wasn't a great central role. God was in charge. And so everyone would do what was right in God's eyes. Would that be a unifying and a society-building approach, right, if everybody was accountable to God and held each other accountable? They would have been intensely separated from the non-believing world. They would have purged idolatry and immorality before it became a temptation, even in their own families, as Deuteronomy says. They wouldn't have formed alliances or covenants except with faithful people. And we saw that. You saw a little like the Kenites, right, dwelling among them, right? And there are others who seem to believe in Jehovah and work with them. So they do have alliances for those. And then their purity and obedience would have been examples to the nations around them. Instead, we saw in this story, they were worse than the Sodomites. And it seemed like over and over, they seemed to exceed the iniquity of the nations around. But it would have been the opposite, the negative image of that picture. They would have been carefully obedient to the written word. Every generation would know the Lord, which didn't happen in Judges 2. The next generation forgot him. They would have carried out the law's consequences. So if there was disobedience, it would have been taken care of, and it would have been a deterrent for others. The word would have filled their lives. They would have worshiped as God instructed. And, of course, the main thing is they would have just been content and trusted in God's care. And if their enemies did arrive, like remember the first one, Cush and Rishathaim, which is way off to the east, eastern Syria, God would just raise up as he did with Othniel, and the Spirit of the Lord would come upon him and he would take care of that as needed. And they wouldn't have to depend on worldly measures of strength. Remember, we pointed out over and over, they didn't have that. They didn't have technology. They didn't have chariots or horses, right, or any kind of a metallurgy that they could depend on. But they didn't need that. Of course, it became a liability when they needed to depend on that instead of on God. Okay, so there's enough of that. Could we do a rapid fire review? And then we'll, yeah, Sewell, yes.
Go back to that chart. That's the church.
I know.
I knew you knew.
No, say more, say more.
But we just must observe that that's true.
Yeah.
It's God's plan from the very beginning. It was for Israel, and it's his plan for us. The independent tribes, but with God as the ruler, it's just the same thing. And I appreciate that. That's a beautiful chart. Thank you.
And who's the king of the church, right? Who's the central authority that keeps us all unified? And you know,
where's the central headquarters?
Yeah, it makes all our decisions for us and all that. Yeah, exactly.
And who is the best king in the United Kingdom?
Yes.
So that would have been David, who was a man after God's own heart. So essentially, the man that let God rule his people was the best king of Israel.
Yeah. All right. Can we do this quick? Help me go quick. Can we do this in 60 seconds? Let's do our Hebrew drills, our recitation. Abi. Everybody go off mute.
Father.
Father. Abimelech.
My father's king.
Beth.
House.
Bethlehem.
House of bread.
Good. Is the same person answering all these? Beer.
Yes.
I guess you're just in a hurry. Have you not had supper yet?
Well.
Ben.
Son of.
Gilgal.
And, rolling.
Rolling. Bochum.
Weeping.
Weeping.
Melech. Hey. El or Elohim?
God.
Havoth.
Villages.
Yes. Villages of Jer. There you go. Yahweh is the personal name of God. We know that. Bethel.
Of God.
House of God. Salem. Shalom. Solomon. All those words.
Peace.
Peace. Jerob Baal. Jerob Baal. Let Baal contend. Which are the tribes east? Well, we've already done them. That where did Dan settle? Laish was the city. Why? They couldn't take the inhabitants. Who was the warlike left-handed tribe?
Benjamin.
What was the quarrelsome rebellious tribe?
Ephraim.
What was the royal tribe?
Judah.
What was the tribe with no land?
Levi.
Who was Samson's father?
Manoah.
Yeah, Manoah, very good. For 200 points, yeah. Who was Othniel's uncle?
Caleb.
Yes. Caleb. Who killed Sisera?
Jael.
Good. Who used an ox goad for a weapon?
Had to be Shamgar.
Yeah, it had to be.
Must have been Shamgar.
30 towns were named for this guy.
Jer?
Yeah. Gideon's bad son.
Abimelech.
Yeah, kings of Midian who were killed. These are hard to remember. Zeba and Zalmunna and Oreb and Zeeb, and I get them mixed up, as you can tell. So the kings were killed by Gideon. The princes were killed by the Ephraimites, I think. The way that worked. Gideon's youngest son, who told the story of the trees, the kingdom of trees.
Yeah.
Close. It's not Jonathan, not Joash. It is Jotham. Who's the lefty judge who had a homemade sword? I guess it was
Ehud.
Yes. Ehud. All right, up to the top over here. What tribe was Othniel from?
Judah?
Yes, good. Ehud. He's Benjamin. Left-handed.
Benjamin?
Yeah. Barak.
Naphtali?
Yes, that's where Hazor was, and that's where the Jabin ruled out of. Gideon. Claimed he was from a small tribe, but it looks pretty big on the map.
Manasseh,
yeah. Samson.
Dan?
Yes, good. Deborah.
Naphtali?
No, Ephraim. She was in the hill country of Ephraim in Bethel.
They needed a judge. Or
near it, anyway. Micah? He wasn't a Danite, but where did he live?
Ephraim?
Yes, hill country of Ephraim. Where did Moab and Ammon originate? Where did they come from?
Lot's
sons by his own daughters. What was the nation that came from Esau?
Edom.
What was Eglon's nation, the fat guy?
Moab.
Good, Moab, great. What was Israel's technological disadvantage?
No arms.
Iron.
Yes. What was the Transjordan nation defeated by Moses? Remember, that was his one victory. The kings were Sion and Og.
Bashan.
Amorites.
Amorites. I have to think about it. Yes. What was Jabin's nation, the one who had the chariots and ruled out of Hazor? Sisera was his captain. Pardon?
Amalekites?
It was called the Canaanites. He's just native to that area. City where Jabin reigned, that was Hazor. Where did Deborah prophesy in the hill country of Ephraim? We already covered that. Location of the ark was Shiloh. Who lived in Jerusalem at this point? We studied
them. Jebusites.
Jebusites.
What was the valley in which many battles took place?
Jezreel,
in the country of Issachar. What mountain did Barak gather the troops?
Tabor,
good. Conical mountain. What was Jephthah's home region? It wasn't it?
Gilead.
Yep, that's right. One of those from over there. Where is Gilead, by the way?
East.
Across the Jordan.
Yeah, Gad and Manasseh. What was the town of the base Benjamites that we studied?
Gibeah.
And then what was Saul's hometown?
Gibeah.
What was the hometown of the Levite's concubine?
Benjamin.
Bethlehem.
What was David's hometown?
Bethlehem.
Where did the Jebusites live? We already talked about that. Jerusalem. So you remember the Jabesh-Gilead connection. The girls provided wives. And then he sent the pieces of the body. How did Barak beat the chariots?
God sent rain and made mud.
Right. The answer is, I guess he didn't.
Flood.
Yeah. Thunderstorm, flood, the river flooded, as well as the rain and so on. And the contemporaneous good story is Ruth. And Naomi's first husband, as we studied, was God is King. Okay? I think we're done. This was going to be my goal for the whole course. I hope we now maybe more firmly believe that God really will judge unfaithfulness in his people. And it may come in the form of us destroying each other, but it may come in the form of an external enemy. And both of those are illustrated in the book of Judges. And that ought to cause some fear. The wrath of God, you know, will be revealed. But if we repent, we need to believe that God will forgive us and he will rescue us. And then life will not always be the same because of what we've done, but we will have God's blessings if we turn. I think we ought to also believe that self-directed living will do intense harm to us as individuals and to the societies we live in. And I, as an old person, I remember Homer Haley used to say, I don't think the nation's going to live much longer. And of course it has, I guess, in some sense, but it just feels like we will, without any value system to depend on, will eventually be self-centered enough and morally deficient enough that we'll do intense harm to this society as well. But I don't know. It's God's plan, not mine. And then I think also the key thing I think about is God still was working his plan to bring the Messiah into the world. And that's maybe a message of the book of Ruth as well, isn't it? In that throughout all this chaos and evil people and strange things, which we don't even know what the right thing to do was, God's plan was marching, perfectly toward bringing the Messiah into the world. And I think sometimes in our lives we can be overly discouraged with the flaws in the people around us that ought to be better. But maybe we need to see that that's maybe God's plan working out too. If we have the right kind of faith, what he wants to happen will happen. And our responsibility is just to do what's right in his eyes. Anyway, I am done. I'm sorry I went over, but we did a quick review. Did you pass the exam? Enough. All right. Any other comments on the book?
Saul of Tarsus was the result of that arrangement for getting wives for the Benjamites.
Interesting. Yeah, that's interesting to think about. Yeah.
Hey, Marty.
Yeah, Teresa.
I did think that if they hadn't made that promise about the Benjamites and not having any of their wives, they wouldn't have been in the situation they were in about not having enough wives.
Yeah, and you know, that's not the first rash vow we've seen in the book, is it?
Thank you, Marty.
Marty, that was great, but you remember to everybody, God wishes that all men be saved, so we ought to go to bed tonight and pray that we can help one of those all men to be saved.
Yeah, I think it's easier for us to, maybe I've done that, Paul, and this is probably a good point. Just throw up her hand and say, well, the society's lost, right? They're no good. Everything's going downhill. But maybe that's the wrong view. Let's think about people, individuals, each one. And that's the way really to look at it.
Thank you, Marty.
All right.
Thank you so much.
I'm going to stop sharing, finally. Y'all probably tired of seeing all these pictures. And...